Hear that? That's the sound of your skin silently crying out for hydration. Luckily, Dr. Teals has just the thing to get you glowing in no time. Meet Dr. Teals Skin Renewal Deep Hydration, made with a proprietary triple magnesium complex plus skincare actives for 50% improved skin hydration after just one bath. The words dry and dehydrated are about to be wiped from your vocabulary. Find Dr. Teals, all dressed in blue, in your local bath aisle. Dr. Teals. Yep. You needed that.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Happy Friday, and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Because it's Friday, we're joined by my colleague, Tim Miller, who is up at the crack of freaking dawn out there on the West Coast. So, Tim, good to have you back again.
Hey, Charlie. Love being here. Just chugging some coffee. So I'll be firing all cylinders by 11-minute mark of this podcast.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of grim stuff that we have to talk about. And I want to talk about Mitch McConnell. And that amazing interview where we saw what I described as the banality of amorality in my newsletter this morning. And obviously things that are going on in Ukraine. I also want to talk about some remarkable things that happened on the Senate floor over the last couple of days. But can we do this as a palate cleanser? I haven't done a palate cleanser in a while.
I need a palate cleanser.
This is a palate cleanser. We used to do this on a regular basis all the time. And I don't know, maybe war and reality has intervened and pushed it aside. But this is, for lack of a better description, a viral video that this individual, and it's not important to know his name because he's just a guy, a viral video that he posted on social media explaining how brilliant he was. And it's just one of those moments where it just raises all kinds of questions. So the guy's sitting in his car. He's this, in case people haven't seen, he's the guy with the mustache. And apparently he's one of the smartest human beings in America. So let's just play this.
You know, a lot of people like to say I'm stupid and uneducated.
Why?
Actually, I'm one of the smartest people in the world. Mm-hmm. You know why? Because I founded the Anti-Maskers Club. Uh-huh. I never wore a mask, never got the vaccine.
Brilliant.
That automatically makes me top 10% highest IQs in the world. Maybe even I might be in the top 1% of the smartest people in the world. So, smarter than all these college kids that wear masks, getting vaccinated. Smarter than all these kids in colleges.
Impressive.
Smarter than all these professors. Smarter than all these doctors. I'm smarter than Dr. Fauci.
Undoubtedly.
Smarter than Trump. Because Trump promoted the vaccine. Smarter than Trump.
Ooh.
Something called street smart and something called book smart. You know, I live in reality. I'm street smart.
Which street? So I posted that and I said, this is the Dunning-Kruger effect come to life. You know, this is, for people who aren't familiar, Dunning-Kruger is, in psychology, the cognitive bias whereby people with limited knowledge in a given intellectual or social domain, greatly overestimate their own knowledge or competence in that domain. In other words, it's people who are too stupid to know that they're stupid. But there's a lot of that. It's a useful thing. It's a useful, I think, concept to keep in mind as you listen to people going, you just have no idea how you sound, do you? But that was pretty.
It is pretty interesting. And it's you know, one of those things
people think, you know,
more
stupid
than anybody have been pleased about the fact that, like, I think that folks came around to the fact that, you know, for the vaccinated rules and regulations should have been drawn down over the past few months. But it is pretty kind of alarming when you stand back and think about it, that there still are several hundred people a day, almost all unvaccinated, dying from the coronavirus. Like, there's a magic drug out there that you can just get a shot and be almost assured that you're not going to die, and yet hundreds of people are dying anyway. And not only are they dying, they're going on to TikTok to tell us how smart they are for not taking this magic drug that the really brilliant scientists came up with in kind of a world historic invention in short time, you know? I mean, it is kind of funny.
Well, I choose to find it funny and not dwell on the fact that geniuses like this guy are probably going to bring back polio and a variety of other things in the future. All right, so let's, one other thing,
I've been watching just kind of because, you know, I'm a man of the people, Charlie, and so I've been getting stuck into TikTok. I'm not one of the 1% smartest people in America, but you know, I like to kind of see what's out there, what the kids are seeing, what everybody's seeing. You know, keeps me relevant for the Snapchat show. So I've been caught into this one. He's kind of like a surfer bro. I think he lives in San Diego, and he just goes up to people on the beach and asks them if they prefer Trump or Biden, these TikToks. And it is alarming.
He's funny. I think I've seen that.
Yeah, he is funny. Yeah. He's great. He's smart, unlike the Dunning-Kruger fella. But when you listen to the responses, I mean, it's just all vibes, man. It's just all like this guy. You know, people are either, I just don't like the smarty elites, and so I got to be with Trump. He's not part of the club. You know, or it's Trump is mean, you know, so I got to be for Biden. But valid reason, the latter, valid reason to be for Biden. But, you know, it takes you to a separate place from as bad as the Twitter discourse is. At least many of the people in the Twitter discourse have like policy priors that they're trying to achieve. When you look at the boardwalk interviews in San Diego. It's a little concerned. I guess what I'm saying is the fella in the car, the Dunning-Kruger guy, is a little closer to the mean than maybe we might want, might want to acknowledge. Yeah.
So here's my pro tip for the weekend, that if you want to retain your faith in democracy and your fellow man, do not watch these TikTok videos. If you want to believe in democracy, don't attend a homeowners meeting association or something like that. There's, you know, it's just like, it's just step back and read a book or something. Just to, you know, keep yourself a little bit optimistic. Okay, so speaking of optimistic, this was really one of the highlights I thought of yesterday. And of course, everybody is talking about it. But Jonathan Swan from Axios sits down with Mitch McConnell. And They talk about a variety of things, but what really struck me was the discussion about the moral red line. And I want to play it. It runs about 2 minutes, but in Jonathan Swan does, like, unlike a lot of American interviewers, and you and I were talking about this before the show, you know, British and Australian interviewers are really aggressive. I mean, they don't let you off the hook. They keep coming back and asking the question. American interviewers do that rarely, which makes, I think, helps Jonathan Swan stand out because he is so good at this. And Mitch McConnell, we'll get to your take on this because in my newsletter, I actually gave you the final word on what we saw here. Jonathan Swan pressing Mitch McConnell on whether he has any moral red lines in his politics. Let's play it.
So moral red lines, where do you draw them?
I'm perfectly comfortable with the way I have conducted my political career, and I'd be happy to respond to any specificity you want to apply to the term. What was it?
Moral red lines.
Moral red line. Mm-hmm. Yeah. With my moral red line.
Let me give you one specific. Ooh. Help me understand this.
Please.
I watched your speech last year in February on the Senate floor after the second impeachment vote on Donald Trump. And it was an extraordinary speech. You spoke very powerfully against the most powerful figure in your party, the president. And you said Donald Trump's actions preceding the January 6th insurrection were a, quote, disgraceful dereliction of duty, and that he was practically and morally responsible, your words, for provoking the events of that day. How do you go from saying that to 2 weeks later saying you'd absolutely support Donald Trump if he's the Republican nominee in 2024?
Well, as the Republican leader of the Senate, it should not be a front page headline that I will support the Republican nominee for president.
After you've said that about him, I think it's astonishing.
I think I have an obligation to support the nominee of my party.
Partisan hack.
And
is there anything they could do?
I will. That will mean that whoever the nominee is has gone out and earned the nomination.
Okay, but Donald Trump earned it last time, and I'm just trying to understand, you know, what you say matters. You're a very important voice in this country. You're the leader of your party, and you seem to hold two concurrent, conflicted positions, which is...
Not at all inconsistent. Not at all inconsistent. I stand by everything I said
I understand, but...
January 6th and everything I said on February the 13th.
I understand that, but what I want to understand, which I haven't heard you address, is...
Because I don't get to pick the Republican nominee for president. They're elected by the Republican voters all over the country.
I fully understand that, but take Liz Cheney, for example.
You want to spend some more time on this as well?
I actually do, because I actually... No, no, I genuinely want to understand this. I really want to understand how you think about this, because Liz Cheney, who has the same view of you as of January 6th, she said she doesn't want Donald Trump anywhere near the White House, and she's going to work to not make that happen, because she thinks that there are some things more important than party loyalty.
Yeah. Well, maybe you ought to be talking to Liz Cheney.
Maybe you should... That was fucking great. That really was. So, Tim Miller,
I'm glad you can enjoy it. It's depressing. Before I get, because I'm gonna get riled up on Mitch. So before I get to Mitch on Swan, it is refreshing, man. You know, and you would feel like we have this whole proliferation of media here, and there's so many outlets on the Hill, and to just be able to singularly separate yourself from the other, not just interviewers, not just cue interviewers, but like folks that are like trolling the halls of Capitol Hill, right? You know, and this is, in some ways, the Swan thing is a parallel to Chain Liz, because it's like the reason why I get so much praise is because we're all just wandering through the desert, just like dying for somebody to just like be honest with these people, right? To like make them have to live up to their bullshit that they have been spreading. So anyway, kudos to John. And on Mitch, I mean, look, as I said, which you said in the newsletter, I mean, his response is hilarious. And it's depressing revealing and hilarious at the same time and revealing, right? It's like he's completely befuddled. It's like a moral red line. I don't even know where to start. He goes into two jokes. Mitch is not a good comedian, but he attempts two jokes. There was a separate point from this, because this goes on. He talks about how his kids like him. And his wife likes him. It's like, and Swan's like, well, there's four. You know, Mitch, it just doesn't occur to him that to have an answer prepared for this, right? Because like the answer is something you don't want to say, which is that he has no moral red lines, obviously. He has no moral. And this is the central element of Mitch McConnell. He is in service to power for his party and to power for himself above all. And there's not anything anybody could do. And it's the theme of the whole interview. They go on to talk about Eric Greitens and Herschel Walker and all of the people running for Senate. And they go on to talk about something I wrote about this week, which is how the Senate and campaign committee is still relentlessly promoting not just Donald Trump himself, but his private businesses. And Mitch is just unbowed by any of those things. He's made uncomfortable by the fact that Jonathan's pressing him on it, but he has no, he doesn't feel as if he needs to try to come up with a justification, because he doesn't need one. If to him, the justification is just power for power's sake.
Well, and that's the amorality of it. As you pointed out, he's completely befuddled by it. Like, what is the phrase? Moral red line? You can tell he kind of thinks of it as a gotcha question. So it's not that he doesn't have a moral red line. He really doesn't even understand the concept of why he should have one. So on my newsletter, I actually was thinking about, you know, what Hannah Arendt wrote. You know, she said, the sad truth is that most evil is done by people who never make up their minds to be good or evil. And she wrote about the banality of evil when she wrote about the, you know, the Eichmann trial and everything. I'm not trying to compare him to Eichmann, but, you know, the banality of evil, that people kind of just drift into it. They don't recognize the moral lines. They don't even understand why they have to have it. And so that's what, listening to the befuddlement, and I think that was the right word that you used, Tim, of Mitch McConnell on this question, is the banality of the amorality. And he is just thoroughly amoral to the point where he just kind of can't even understand why he's being asked. Why even asking me these things? Why would it even be newsworthy that a man that I think is an absolute disgrace for the country ought to be president? I mean, really, is that, you know, Jonathan, you really want to spend more time on all this? Yes, we do. Because, you know, but it is
just to this point,
a very
though,
revealing moment.
Yeah, extremely revealing, because it also reveals that, to your point about the banality of it all, I don't know that Mitch McConnell even, like, ever thinks about it in these terms, and like might not even think about himself as being immoral.
Amorality. It doesn't even factor in. Now I know people will say, no, he is evil. No, well, okay, but I think that if you want to understand what's happening to our culture and to our politics, the Mitch McConnells who like, what are you even talking about? It's like you're asking him a question. I don't know. What analogy do I want to use? You know, something, of completely irrelevant. Like, tell us your thoughts on platypus reproduction. Like, what? It's just like, I'm the senator.
You really want to spend more time on platypus reproduction?
That's right. Because, I mean, Herschel Walker, fine, beats his wife. That's, Eric Greitens, ties up a woman, and photographs her and everything. But, really, you think that you really care that, why I would justify supporting him for the United States Senate? So just one more
on the McConnell mindset for the listeners who aren't steeped in this and don't know these assholes. This culture of, kind of politics is a game, right? Like people in politics call it like, hey, I'm in the game. Like if you're a campaigner, in the same way that like people in drug dealing movies call it the game. People who are in the politics of politics really do. It is a game. Like it's a competition. There's some underlying principles. I do think that Mitch generally thinks the government should be smaller rather than bigger or whatever. But he sees himself as a tactician, as a player inside this game where the ultimate goal is to win. And so in that context of this as just this big imaginary game of Risk or whatever, this big imaginary multiplayer live action role play, he doesn't see a contradiction in saying that Donald Trump in giving his speech on February 13th and then saying he would support Donald Trump on February 27th, because his speech on February 13th was to try to help save the brand of his team, right? Like his speech on February 13th was to try to help, stop the bleeding from what was happening with the Republican Party. His actions on February 27th, saying he'd support Donald Trump, his actions letting his campaign committee send out a million emails about Donald Trump are about the next game, are about winning the next election, and you need to raise money to do that. So for him, it's like, I told what I thought was the truth on February 13th, which was that he acted immorally, and then I did what I thought was needed on February 27th, which is we need this immoral man on our side if we're going to win elections. And I don't see any conflict in that, because that is in service to winning this big game.
That's Mitch McConnell's
mindset. I know, but I think that for some people, it's important to understand that. Think about all of these rationalizations. It could be for the money. It could be for all these other reasons. His brain is completely warped. And so then when Swan comes in and tries to unwarp it and say, okay, well, let's like step back for a second and say, is there anything? Is there any moral red line that would break this way that you think about the game? And for Mitch, it's like, does not compute.
Right. It's not like, no. It's like, what are you even talking about?
Right.
Okay, so there are a lot of other things in this interview, including discussion of the Supreme Court, where I think that anyone who has followed Mitch McConnell for any amount of time understands that he was essentially signaling that if Republicans take control of the Senate, that even in 2023, there's no chance that they will even take up a Biden nominee to the Supreme Court. So once again, the bar has been moved, the goalposts have been moved. They will just sit on the nominees. Would that be your take on this? This is massive news.
And Mitch, again, it goes to, the crowd that's like, well, Biden was going to expand the Supreme Court or whatever, and they looked into a committee.
Yeah.
The imbalance, right? Like, the same people, then, it'll be, the baseball guy at David at National Review or whatever, the same people like come up with some convoluted way where it's like, well, Mitch McConnell doesn't have to take up hearings on this because in 1832, they'll come up with some just rationalization and justification for this. Mitch McConnell sees blocking Merrick Garland as the most significant thing that he did. He suffered no political penalty for it. Obviously, Donald Trump went on to win the election. He maintained his role as Senate Majority Leader. The Supreme Court seat went from being Garland to Gorsuch, and then the Amy Coney Barrett in a much closer to the election instance 4 years later, they jammed it through. And I don't think that they feel like they paid any political penalty for that. It's not as if Amy Coney Barrett was the reason that Trump lost the election, or that the Georgia Senate seats went down. That wasn't even really an issue. in the election. And so if you look at that fact pattern, if you're Mitch McConnell and you say, and let's say Clarence Thomas, you know, has a heart attack or whatever next year, and you're the Senate majority leader, why would you? Why would you commit to it? Right. And for Mitch, again, in this context of the game, why would you? So this is Jonathan once again, I think, exposing that. And now I think it's incumbent upon Democrats and any remaining Republicans of good conscience to try to say this all has gone too far.
So we had to acknowledge what happened yesterday as well. Speaking of the way the United States Senate has changed, Ketanji Brown Jackson confirmed the first African-American woman to the court. The vote was 53-47. A lot of commentary about this sort of, performative assholery of people like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton and Josh Hall.
Tom
and all
Cotton,
of those guys.
Managed. It's always you just want to shout out somebody when they're like in a room full of assholes. You just stand on top of everybody's shoulders and I'm like, I'm the biggest asshole.
Well,
so kudos to Tom Cotton for that.
So Mitch McConnell, is completely amoral. Guys like Cruz and Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley have decided they want to weaponize their assholery. And they know that the bigger asshole they are, the more attention they get, the more they distinguish themselves. And they also know that right now they're not paying a political price for it. So for them, this performative assholery is a rational choice. But I want to talk about what happened right after the vote. So the vote, which everybody knew was going to happen, 53-47, whether you like her jurisprudence or not, I think she's an admirable person. It's a significant moment. I mean, this feels like now that I'm really like the olds from a different century. There's a moment of graciousness and defeat where you go, okay, so yes. I opposed you because I do not agree with your positions, but I'm able to acknowledge the moment. So there was all of this applause and there was cheering. And then the Republicans, led by Mitch McConnell, turned on their heels and they walked out. They all walked out. So you see the video. And about the only Republican who was left there is Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney stays, and he's standing, and he's applauding because he's a classy guy. And, just leaving aside all the politics of it, would it have been that hard for Mitch McConnell and the Republicans to have just a moment of grace, of a little bit of class? Or is that just completely now obsolete in American politics, and including the floor of the Senate, which used to be a place, where people behaved reasonably well? I mean, what do you think?
I mean, I think that at least in the short term, it's obsolete in the GOP. I think back to 08, with McCain in his concession speech. I didn't know you were going here, so I don't have the exact quote in front of me. But I remember McCain, congratulates Obama in a pretty standard manner. I wasn't, anything overly effusive.
And the
crowd starts booing. Right? Yeah. There's this like kind of overwhelming booing at it. At his a victory party, his election night party in Arizona. So this is, I guess, people that came to John McCain's election night party, right? So it wasn't the deplorables. I mean, maybe there are a handful of deplorables, right? But I just think about the kind of crowd that would show up at John McCain's election night party in Arizona. You would think kind of a mainstream activist Republican crowd booing his gentlemanly acknowledgement of Obama. And then he kind of riffs after that and says no, and he chastises the crowd basically and says no, we need to, he's the president for all the country, etc. Kind of acknowledges the moment, first black president, how amazing this is. And this is an analogous situation, right? It's the first black woman on the Supreme Court, and to have Mitt Romney be in the John McCain role, right? It's like, here's the one person, right? It's the one person who's like, can we just be decent for a minute and acknowledge, for the young black girls out there in particular, but for the whole country, like this moment of, the country has been, it's been hundreds of years, we've had hundreds of years of Supreme Court nominees. And now we finally, for the first time, have one black woman to just acknowledge that, even if we're going to disagree with some of her rulings. I do think that the party's beyond that because it's a bottom up thing, right? You go back to that 08 crowd. Yeah. The 08 crowd, the crowd didn't want that. They didn't want it then, and McCain was going in contrast to what his own voters wanted. And eventually, there was obviously going to be an end date to how long that could last.
So this is an interesting point, because John McCain clearly was willing to push back against the booing from his own supporters. But the modern generation, the Cruises, the Cottons, etc., they are afraid of being booed by their base on Twitter and social media, and they're not willing to push back, and maybe it's a generational thing. Okay, so Tim Miller.
Yeah,
I want to talk about your piece about social media, the incredible faceplant of the what is it? Truth Social.
Truth Social. Yeah.
Trump's latest iteration of his failed businesses and the way the Republican establishment went all in and promoting it, and the thing is a complete disaster. I also want to talk about how the culture war is coming for gays and lesbians. I have to admit that I did not have that on my particular dance card. Maybe you think I am naive. And the one speech on the floor of the United States Senate that that I wanted to share with the with the audience, where you had a senator who just dismantles Josh Hawley. If you have not heard it, stick around. We're going to do it right after
that's
this.
A tease.
People say that puffiness and bags under the eyes are the hardest things to get rid of until now. Introducing Genucel Plant Stem Cell Therapy. Some studies show that plant stem cell therapy can help target eye puffiness and bags. Due to this new technology, Genucel is an incredibly powerful natural serum. And with its instant effects, it's guaranteed to show results in as little as 12 hours or your money back. That's right. Some users saw results in only 12 hours with dramatic improvement in 2 weeks. I have some friends who just rave about this. Genucel contains 8 extra ingredients and uses plant stem cell technology to help get longer lasting and brilliant results. So go to genucel.com/bulwark right now to try risk-free. Say goodbye to puffiness and bags today. Order right now with our special code BULWARK to get an instant 10% off your order. Genucel promises the best skincare, best results, or your money back. Go to genucel.com/bulwark. That's genucel.com/bulwark. Okay, we are back. Tim Miller. I suppose this is slightly inconsistent, having talked about the death of civility. I was amazed by this speech on the floor of the Senate, I think it was yesterday, by Hawaii Democratic Senator Brian Schatz, who I don't know really much about. I'm guessing that he and I probably wouldn't have, you know, a beer together or anything. But he just takes apart Josh Hawley. Also an indication, I think, of our politics, because I don't think there's any secret here that Brian Schatz despises Josh Hawley. These guys are definitely not going out for coffee after all of this. But this is definitely worth your time.
He is blocking the staffing of the senior leadership at the Department of Defense. And this comes from a guy who raised his fist in solidarity with the insurrectionists. And this comes from a guy who, before the Russian invasion, suggested that maybe it would be wise for Zelensky to make a few concessions about Ukraine and their willingness to join NATO. This comes from a guy who just about a month ago voted against Ukraine aid. He's saying it's going too slow. He voted no. He voted no on Ukraine aid, and now he has the gall to say it's going too slow. And this final insult is that until, what, Secretary Austin resigns? That's not a serious request. People used to come to me during the Trump administration all the time. Do you think Trump should resign? Do you think Tillerson should resign? That's a stupid, of course, I think all the people I disagree with should quit their jobs and be replaced with people I love. Of course, I think they should all resign. That's not how this world works. That is not a reasonable request from a United States senator, that until the Secretary of Defense quits his job, I'm going to block all of his nominees. That's preposterous. And coming from a person who exonerated Donald Trump for extorting Zelensky for withholding lethal aid.
Okay, so, but the only thing missing there is Schatz saying, so fuck you, Josh Hawley. Really? Okay, so.
I'll add that to the end. So yeah, fuck you, yeah, Josh Hawley.
And this is how it ends.
And so spare me the new solidarity with the Ukrainians and with the free world, because this man's record is exactly the opposite.
This man. In other words,
my friend.
The gentleman from Missouri, my good friend. Boy, that's a long time ago. But you know, I mean, this was one where you go, you know, finally, yes, you know, go back at these guys, call them out on this. And I guess this is why, you know, Brian Schatz's speech is getting so much attention, because, you know, instead of the usual mumble, you know, this is really, you know, deplorable, whatever. He just takes it to Josh Hawley. And by the way, just the substance here, that we're in the middle of an international crisis, a war in the heart of Europe. And Josh Hawley has decided to not just be a, you know, performative asshole, but to use his power as United States Senate to block the confirmation of key Defense Department officials that he is actually attacking the Defense Department. Look, if Democrats cannot wrap that around the neck of Republicans, they should find a new line of work.
Yeah, just to your going way, way back before you entered the thing, you apologized at the start saying that, you know, it's a little inconsistent to be arguing for civility and then, you know, sort of slam dunking Josh Hawley. I don't know about that, actually. I mean, I think that people who are being hypocritical assholes can still be called out for being hypocritical assholes while being civil, right? I mean, like, there are certain moments that call for unity, right? As you said, there's a war in the heart of Europe, right? I mean, I think that if the Republicans were acting in good faith and trying to help the Biden administration, you know, make decisions, maybe at times criticizing them, but doing so earnestly with the effort of making sure America is doing the best we can to support our allies in Ukraine, and that there were Republicans who were willing to stand side by side with Biden and help them, then yeah, that would call for Democrats on the Senate to be civil and to be gracious to their Republican colleagues who are, you know, working side by side in this moment of crisis. That's maybe happening in a few cases with a few Republicans like Mitt, but that's not what's happening with people like Josh Hawley, right? And so you can call out hypocrites while still being civil in times that call for civility. And you have people like Josh Hawley and others. He's not alone. Cruz was saying this too, for example, you know, who were saying before the war that we shouldn't do anything about this. We should only care about our own border. You know, we shouldn't be helping the Ukrainians. We shouldn't be sending weapons, voting against weapons, as Schatz points out. You know, people who defended Donald Trump when he blocked, you know, when he tried to coerce Zelensky into investigating Hunter Biden if he was going to get the weapons that he needed to protect himself from the Russian threat. People who did all of that and then now have the gall to be like, Joe Biden's not doing enough. Fuck those people, okay? Screw them. And thank God, you know, someone is out there to call it out, because the Republicans, you know, many Republicans have been trying to have this both ways, have been trying to, you know, attack Joe Biden for being a globalist or whatever, you know, when that was the you know, in vogue attack, to a few weeks later attacking Joe Biden for not being tough enough. That is not standing with the Ukrainians. Like, that is, you know, more performative assholery, right? And so I think that Schatz's speech was very appropriate. I think him and Murphy are the Democrats' best folks on social media in the Senate. And frankly, the Democrats should be doing more to get these guys in front of cameras, because Democrats need more good messengers right now. And, you know, the White House is struggling on this front. Schumer is a disaster. Pelosi is okay, you know, at times better than others, but, you know, obviously isn't the type of person who is messaging to the big middle. So, you know, more Schatz and Murphy, as far as I'm concerned, would be helpful for the Democrats. More of this would be good.
Okay, so we had a lot of great stuff in the Bulwark this week. I think this is one of our strongest weeks. And one of my favorite stories was by you. And I'm not just saying that because you're there. Your piece on Trump social media, the Republican Party is Trump stakes. Truth Social, the president's latest private sector scam to flop, was promoted relentlessly by official GOP accounts. And as you begin the article, which I strongly recommend, it has been an inauspicious start for Truth Social, the former president's new Twitter knockoff, helmed by bovine ex-Congressman Devin Nunes. Oh, it's just, there's so much going on here. So, I mean, you know, first of all, the fact that Trump has just failed so miserably once again. I mean, this has been one of my big frustrations, that he has this image, that Donald Trump has this image of being a successful businessman, when in fact he has failed at one business after another. I think in part because he actually doesn't care about how the business runs. He just thinks if he slaps his name on it. So you have Trump Steaks and Trump Airlines and, you know, Trump University, et cetera.
The board game. Don't forget the Trump, the board game.
The board game. We could go on the Trump magazine, the Trump water. There was all of these failed businesses. But what's fascinating about this is that this thing is a complete disaster. It's a complete flop. But as you remind people, people like Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell and the entire Republican official hierarchy was all in pimping for this social media site. So talk to me about that, because that is amazing.
Yeah, I think that's a key story. I needed to, you know, clear my throat a little bit at the front by making fun of all Trump's failed businesses Devin Nunes. You know, just point of personal privilege, the first couple of paragraphs. But to me, the news here, what I wanted this article to bring that I felt was absent from the discourse among the political media, is just how lockstep, hand in hand, more than that. I mean, the official Republican Party has been the biggest PR operation on behalf of Donald Trump's private sector scam company, right? So it's one thing, you know, for Swan to ask McConnell, why is the NRSC sending out so many emails promoting Donald Trump even after the insurrection? Fair question. Should the party really be promoting this person still so relentlessly? But we've discussed that a lot. It's a separate matter for the RNC, for the NRSC. That's the National Republican Senate Committee, the National Republican Congressional Committee, individual candidates to be texting, emailing, tweeting, Facebook, running ads, asking people to sign up for Truth Social, telling people to stick it to the left by signing up for Truth Social, telling people that the only way that you're a good patriot is if you sign up for Truth Social. The NRSC sent me in the course of March 19 emails supporting Truth Social. 19 in the middle of the Ukraine war. You know, the Senate committee could be emailing about anything: inflation, gas prices, Ukraine. You know, all of the important issues. 19 emails they sent. Sign up for Truth Social today. Stick it to the big tech elite, stick it to the left. I mean, this is, you know, both a scam, but also corruption. It's plain as day corruption. We spent a lot of time last week. I got some angry emails from listeners who are upset that I was upset about the Hunter Biden laptop and saying that Hunter Biden was acting, was trading on his dad's name for personal gain. No matter what you think about all of it, that's not good. The DNC isn't then sending out emails that's like, hey, sign up for Burisma, Hunter Biden's company, like support, what is happening on the Republican side is an active effort by campaign and politicians, public servants, Marco Rubio texting me, like threatening me.
Marco Rubio.
Little Marco threatening me over text to sign up for Trump's private company so that he can make money.
So you got a text from Marco Rubio saying, are you joining Truth Social? Friend, ignore again, and we'll tell Trump you surrendered to big tech. 30 minutes left to update your status. Tim, we're watching you, Tim.
Wagging his little stubby little finger at me.
Don't you disappoint us, Tim. Otherwise, I am going to tell Trump you surrendered, Tim. I mean,
what is the difference between that? Do you get these calls, you know, who's like, you know, you get a call and you pick up the phone and it's whatever your number. And it's like, you know, and the person's like, hey, have you updated your insurance yet? I'm looking at, are you Tim? It looks like your home insurance is waiting. And then you're like, okay, well, who is this again? And then it's like, oh, okay, this is just a scammer trying to get me to, like, what is the difference between the scam calls that are trying to trick old people into...
Zero.
And this, there's nothing, right? Like, it's a scam. Like, they're just running a total scam. Marco Rubio, by the way, can't even sign you up for Truth Social. So that threat, once you click on that, it's just like Marco's like, just give me, tell me what your sign-up name will be for Truth Social and then give me 35 bucks.
I'm just trying to imagine the phone call. President Trump, this is Marco. Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio from Florida. Remember me. I wanted to call you to tell you that Tim Miller has surrendered to big tech. And I thought you needed to know. But it's not just him. It's like Rick Scott, Steve Daines from Montana, Josh Hawley, of course, Chuck Grassley, who's too old to know what he's doing, Bill Hagerty, Mike Crapo, James Lankford, what the hell? Roger Marshall, Deb Fisher, all of these. I love Marsha Blackburn in your story. Writing under the nom de plume, Pelosi for never, whatever, emailed supporters to say that her goal is to add 500 new patriots to Truth Social in the next 5 minutes. Yeah, this is...
She's like the person in the call basement. You know, it's like a boiler room. She's the person in the boiler room. And, you know, Donnie's up there saying, you got to get me 500. You got to get me 500 in 5 minutes, you know, if you want to get the steak at the end of, you know, at the end of the week. I mean, like, it's crazy that they're doing this and that nobody notices. And this is all part of, it really ties into what we're saying at the beginning about this all being a game, right? The reason why I write this, right, is because political reporters are all getting these emails and texts too. But it's like, you know, everybody's just been so beaten down by the scam, right? And they're just like, this isn't news. It's like, oh, whatever. They're sending me texts about Truth Social. It's like, it is kind of news, right? Like, the president has a scam company, and that the entire Republican Party seems committed to doing PR for it in the months after he incited a domestic terrorist attack on the Capitol. I don't know. To me, like, it's silly. It's funny. It's mockable. It's like much in the Trump era. I was listening to you and Tom yesterday talk about old Rudy Giuliani. It's like, it's both dark comedy and very... And serious corruption at the same time. It can be both.
Yeah, it can be the dark comedy, I think. Okay, so let's talk about the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida and what's happening now. But look, I understand there's tremendous pushback that it's not to say Don't Say Gay. But, and I mentioned this before, look, I expected that Republicans were going to make a big issue of transgender issues, particularly, you know, transgender athletes. Yeah. That was definitely something that was predictable. But what's interesting is that they seem to have sort of slingshotted around trans rights and gone right for gays and lesbians. And so this is now at the center of the culture war. Look, you know, what is your take on this? I mean, are you surprised by this? Because now this is spreading. This has become a thing. And it's become acceptable in Republican circles. And by the way, by Republican circles, you know, one of the things we've seen is how the fringe has been absorbed by the establishment. There's not the kind of distinction there used to be, so that it's now common to have intellectual right-wing publications, you know, explain why it is okay to call political opponents groomers, to imply that they are pro-pedophile if, in fact, they oppose legislation that is targeting gays or the discussion of gays. So are you surprised by this?
Yeah, I'm surprised. Okay, complacent. We got complacent. The gays got complacent. You know, we thought we'd won. You know, we were skinny and happy and going to Rehoboth Beach, Fire Island, you know, just enjoying our little vodka sodas. But they're back. They're coming back for us. The premise, the original article I wrote for the Bulwark about the Don't Say Gay bill was written February 15th. I looked at this yesterday. So only about 6 weeks ago. And the premise of that article was I was seeing some chatter about this bill. You know, there was the beginnings of the pushback among the kind of gay activist set on the left. There's the beginnings of the defense among, you know, kind of the social conservative side on the right. Ben Shapiro was sort of the tip of the spear on this. And I was like, is this a real thing? You know, because a lot of times this happens, right? You know, some crazy state legislator in South Dakota or whatever proposes something, and then everybody gets outraged, and MSNBC does a thing on it, and then Breitbart defends it, and it's like, well, this was never going to be anything anyway. So I was like, is this that, or is this a real thing? And I wasn't sure. And my instinct kind of said it was the former, actually, that this just wasn't Don't Say Gay. Like, really, this is what they're going to fight about right now? And
I had the same reaction.
I learned very quickly. I made some calls to some of my old friends in Florida, you know, who are in touch with what's happening in Tallahassee. And I learned very quickly that it was not actually performative and that very well was going to pass. And I tried to sound the alarm bell on February 15th saying, this is real. Like, this is going to pass. Ron DeSantis is going to sign it. And back then, in February 15th, it was in the most literal sense of Don't Say Gay bill, because the original draft said, you know, there's no discussion. They changed that to instruction. Marginally better. But I think this, well, in my opinion,
the preamble still has the word discussion in it, though.
Yeah, the preamble still has the discussion. Very well lawyered, as Ilya Shapiro said. This is so well lawyered, very precise. The preamble still has discussion. They changed it to instruction. And my friend Gabriel Mailer, who is a legal expert on Twitter, more conservative than me, expert, was saying, I still think that this is Don't Say Gay, because if you look at a book like Heather Has Two Mommies, you can't now have that be part of an instruction. Like, you know, that's just a standard children's book about how families come in different. Some people have one mom, some people have two moms, some people have one dad, some people have, you know, grandparents, you know, because their parents died. And it's just like a book about how all families are beautiful. That can't be now read in school. So if that can't be read, is that not Don't Say Gay? Anyway, Louisiana, a state that I've been, you know, kind of flirting with maybe moving to at some point, now has a bill that they're working on. They have a Democrat, conservative Democratic governor. I'm not sure if they'll have the votes to do an override of a veto on this, but they have a bill that is, in the literal sense of the term, don't ask, don't tell for gay teachers. Mm-hmm. It has all of the Don't Say Gay stuff from the Florida legislation. And on top of that, they are proposing that teachers at any level, not K to 5, K to 12, teachers cannot discuss the sexual orientation of their partner or whatever, something like that. And so, you know, that's kind of like, can I say that I have a wife then if I'm a man? Is that discussing our sexual orientation? Of course, that's not a problem. But so they're looking to bring back Don't Say Gay for teachers. And as we said on the discussion first instruction thing, I think last week on this podcast, I think other states will go to the more extreme initial bill, right? But, you know, because they have more Republican legislatures and senators and, you know, people want to run for president, want to show up Ron DeSantis and et cetera. You see the impact of this in Texas already. A school district in Irving, kind of a conservative exurb, the public school, the principal ordered that they take down all of the rainbow stickers.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. From the windows. Yeah, take down all the rainbow stickers. A teacher, a gay teacher, objects. Now they're, you know, as they didn't like the way that the gay teacher objected. And now it, you know, it seems like, I think that obviously lawyers are getting involved in all this, like that teacher's going to be fired. So like this is very real. The real life impact of this is already being demonstrated. And, you know, obviously, you know, there's continuing kind of hate, you know, sprouting up, particularly targeting trans individuals, but also gays. There's a gay bar arson recently. And to your point, this has been mainstreamed. These types of bills, they're reframing it as not anti-gay. It's parental rights. A parent has the right to object. You know, a parent has the right to object. If they don't like Heather has two mommies, then a parent has the right to object. This isn't about the gays. This is just about parents and having total control over the curriculum. And that position is being advanced by not just the crazy MAGAs. It is being advanced by everyone in the Republican coalition, all the way up to people that have basically have already left the Republican coalition, right? And even the Trump skeptical commentators on the right have basically been in lockstep in support of this. And so this is coming.
And the polls would suggest, though, that parental rights are popular. So there's got to be some way of saying that, yes, we are going to respect parental rights, but we are not going to do X, Y, and Z. I'm not sure that we've had that formula. I will tell you the thing that is the most dangerous, you know, watching from the outside here, is this very, very casual, but suddenly very, very widespread conflation of being gay with being a child molester. Yeah. And this feels like it's a throwback to decades ago, where that if you are a gay teacher, then you know, we need to think of you as a potential pedophile. And if you talk about these things, it is because you are grooming children for pedophilia. This is where you move from, you know, from I felt like we were on this trajectory to tolerance. Now we are on this trajectory to really demonization in a very, very dangerous way. And I know that we throw words like hate around too much, but if you convince large numbers of people that gay men who teach in schools are potential pedophiles, the consequences could be really ugly and very dangerous.
Yeah, and this goes back to, and we're in 1978 again. And this is Briggs Initiative. Yeah, this is the Briggs Initiative in California. We've all been here already.
Reagan, remind me, what was the Briggs Initiative?
Yeah, so the Briggs Initiative was a ballot amendment in California that Briggs was the state senator, I think, that was going to ban gay teachers from the classroom, right, on this, all these same arguments. Reagan, obviously, was you know, not perfect, okay, when it comes to gays. Yeah. That is an understatement. And he was horrible in AIDS, horrible in HIV. But I talked to one of his advisors, when I moved out here, you know, kind of an old hand who advised him in California. I just had one of these coffee meetings, and he told me about this. And if you go back to, you know, these efforts to ban gay teachers in the classroom in California when back when Reagan was governor. The polling on it was horrible, you know, and he knew he wanted to run for president. And, you know, you see this defense to your point about polling. It's like, well, the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida is 70-30. It's like, well, okay. I mean, you know, if you tell people, if you ask people in a poll, like, do you want kindergartners to, you know, learn about 69ing? Like, yeah, that's gonna not be popular, okay? Right. So if you, it's very easy for you know, demagogues to, like, make this seem popular. We've lived through all of this, right? And Reagan in that one instance did the right thing on this. And he said, and he basically remembers saying, you know, the advisor told me he remembers him saying, like, this is just wrong. Like, these teachers are good people that are just trying to teach in the classroom, and this is wrong. And he came out at the very end and campaigned and you know,
really
said, yeah, did not oppose this ballot initiative. The ballot initiative failed.
Which took guts. You know, yeah, Tim, you should write about that. Because you know what? That also shows that it is possible to take a courageous stand. And taking that stand in 1978 seems to me to be much riskier than taking a stand for tolerance in 2022.
Yeah, exactly. And, again, this is it's very not a perfect man. Yeah, it's not hagiography, right? It's like, this is like a person that was trying to make judgments, said, this is too far. Firing gay teachers, that was... You know, this was going to mandate that gay teachers should be fired. Yeah, you should look it up.
I've learned something. I feel smarter after this podcast.
We are not, you know, exactly there. But boy, if you're already looking at a teacher in Texas getting fired, if you're already looking at, you know, bringing back Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, for teachers in the classroom. I mean, this has a lot more parallels to that than it does differences.
Very interesting. Tim Miller. Thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Have a great weekend.
Charlie, I am going to have a good weekend. I'm closing with one thing for people. Okay, are you ready? Is this okay?
Yeah.
You said at the beginning, you were like, you know, just get off of, if you want to care about democracy, get off TikTok, read a book. You know, I've been focusing on book reading. So I'm myself for the same thing, mental health. So I want a book club partner here, okay, from one of our listeners. I want to read Hanya. I'm going to butcher her last name, Yanagihara, I think. Her new book is called To Paradise. I loved her last two books. But this book is like I don't know, like 1,300 pages or something. I don't know how long it is. It's just so fucking long. And so, you know, I sometimes it's nice to have somebody that's like spurring you forward. This is my offer to listeners who want to, you know, get off of Twitter and TikTok and engage in a little fiction reading. I'm going to begin To Paradise this weekend. You can email me or DM. My DMs are open. I'm going to begin To Paradise this weekend. And, you know, we can have a little informal book club if you want to enjoy the, you know, 900 pages or whatever it is together.
It's interesting you say that because I've been going through the same thing, which is that, you know, instead of I could always binge watch the latest show, but I think, you know what, I'm going to try to read more. And I have been, and I am I'm in the middle of doing sort of a binge reading of Alexander McCall Smith books, but also have just begun reading the late Terry Teachout's biography of H.L. Mencken, which is absolutely fabulous. What a tragedy it is that Terry Teachout died so young. But you and I should talk about that at some point.
Yeah, Terry Teachout's amazing. Yeah, we can do. There you go. That's a good option for people. H.L. Mencken, if you want nonfiction. To Paradise, if you want fiction. We're giving our listeners, you know, two different tracks.
Exactly. All right. Have a great weekend.
See you, Charlie.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio production by Jonathan Siri. I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. And we'll be back tomorrow to do this all over again.